Hello and welcome back to Opposition Cast from the Centre for Opposition Studies. I'm Nigel Fletcher. And this episode's coming to you perhaps a little earlier than you might have expected. We're generally working to about a two-week schedule, although we did breach that a couple of weeks ago, but we won't mention that. This puts us back on schedule in any case. And I did say at the start of the series that we would have the occasional special episode react to events as they happen. And of course, we have had an event this morning. It's Friday the 1st of March. Happy St. David's Day to everybody. This is the sound that many of us heard on the radio this morning. A voice that we perhaps hoped we might have heard the last of some years ago. This is George Galloway, who has won the Rochdale by-election. And this is what he said in his acceptance speech in the early hours of this morning.
That Keir Starmer's problems just got 100 times more serious than they were before today. This is going to spark a movement, a landslide, a shifting of the tectonic plates in scores of parliamentary constituencies, beginning here in the North West, in the West Midlands, in London, from Ilford to Bethnal Green and Bow. Labour is on notice that they have lost the confidence of millions of their voters who loyally and traditionally voted for them generation after generation.
A typically understated George Galloway there in his remarks in his acceptance speech this morning. But I think it does highlight an issue that perhaps could be quite serious for the Labour Party and for Keir Starmer in the months to come, which is that George Galloway's presence in Parliament, speaking up on the issue of Gaza, putting them under great pressure on that, adds to some of the difficulties, as he was saying there. But also it does make the point that this could have an impact at the ballot box as well, that whether it is other candidates of the what George Galloway is calling the Workers' Party of Britain, or whether it's another sort of party or candidates, it does show there is the pressure, the potential for pressure to be exerted on Labour from the left, not just in Parliament and in their party, but also at the ballot box. But having said that, I don't think we should get too carried away. This by-election was quite extraordinary, and we had a Labour candidate having to be suspended and after the close of nominations, and so effectively he was on the ballot as a Labour candidate but not getting the support of the Labour Party and being disowned by them. And so that is a bit of an odd situation. It does skew the result. And so George Galloway perhaps might not have won it had the candidate for the Labour Party actually been campaigning or being campaigned for by the Labour Party. So we can't really take it as a as much of an indication. It's often said, I think, by-elections get sort of over-analysed as a sign of something very significant, and often they're not. But I think this one will have an impact. It puts George Galloway back in Parliament. And whatever you think of him, that is something which will certainly change the nature of the debate on certain issues. And of course, he will, as he is very good at, make the most of that opportunity to promote himself and appear quite regularly on the media. So we have that to look forward to. But I do think it's important to note that this does underline the importance of the issue of Gaza, it's not just in Parliament, as we saw last week on the Opposition Day debate, that it is having an impact, that it is potentially having a real-world impact in UK politics at the ballot box as well. At the same time, the issue is also causing some debate over the right to protest, with some comments from the Home Secretary James Cleverly in the last week about the regular protests that are now taking place on the issue of Palestine and Gaza, and James Cleverly suggesting that protesters have made their point and should go home, that not going down very well. I think that's an issue that we may come back to to discuss is the issue of legitimate protest, because it is one of the things that was discussed in relation to the Rochdale by-election as well. The Reform Party claiming that the result is invalid because they were suggesting that their candidates and workers were being intimidated during the course of the campaign. There are issues around the background to last week's debate in Parliament that are still rumbling on as well in regard to the pressure that's being put on Labour MPs. So I think coming back to the issue of the right to protest and how protest impacts on politics is one that I think is particularly interesting to discuss at this time. But on this episode, we're going to be returning to a type of opposition seen within Parliament, and that is the pressure exerted by backbench MPs on their leadership, something that we've become quite familiar with seeing in politics in recent years. And in the Conservative Party, one example of that has been the prominence that has been given to the 1922 Committee, which is the grouping of backbench Conservative MPs. As various Conservative leaders and Prime Ministers have fallen victim to uprisings from their backbenches and face votes of no confidence, we've seen the figure of Sir Graham Brady, the chairman of the 1922 Committee, becoming a household name and becoming quite a familiar sight, standing in Committee Room 14 reading out the result of various ballots. But what is the 1922 Committee? Well, the best person to ask is the person who's just written the book on it, which is Professor Philip Norton, Lord Norton of Louth, who is, of course, one of the world's great experts on Parliament. And I had a conversation with Philip yesterday in which we discussed the 1922 Committee, its impact and history. But before we got on to talking about that, I wanted to take the opportunity to talk to Philip about the controversy we saw last week that we discussed on last week's podcast from the SNP's Opposition Day debate on Gaza. And since that, we have seen the pressure on Lindsay Hoyle, the Speaker of the House of Commons, continue to grow. And the number of MPs signing the early day motion, registering their no confidence in Lindsay Hoyle, has grown up to, I think, over 90 as of this morning. So we're getting close to 100 MPs, which is quite a significant number. So I began our conversation, before we got on to talk about the 1922 Committee, I began by asking Philip just how significant it is that we've seen that public registration of dissent against the Speaker.
It's quite remarkable to have so many MPs. Well, it's remarkable in the first place to have MPs putting down a motion, which is the only way you can formally criticise the Speaker, have a motion of no confidence tabled as an early day motion. For that to happen in itself is remarkable, and then to attract the number of signatures it has is really rather significant. We've had speakers in recent years become quite controversial. Indeed, it's two predecessors, Burko and John Burko and Michael Martin, attracted criticism, and so came under pressure to go. But this time, to have it quite so, if you like, formally expressed by motion to the extent it has, is quite remarkable. Now, it's actually centuries since a speaker has actually been removed via vote, but has been removed by a vote of the House. And there are two ways it got rid of formally. One is by a vote of no confidence, and the other is by not being re-elected at the start of a new parliament. Now, the last time a speaker was actually voted out on a vote of no confidence was Sir John Trevor in 1695. But since then, two speakers, Sir Fletcher Norton and Charles Manners Sutton, were failed to be re-elected. The most recent was Charles Manners Sutton in 1835. So that just shows how exceptional it is for members to actually either remove a speaker or deny a speaker re-election. So we are in, historically, exceptional circumstances.
And what are your thoughts on the decision last week? I mean, clearly we saw the letter from the Clerk of the House setting out the position. And I think it was quite interesting to see that this is not an ancient procedure. This is actually something that we can thank Norman St. John Stevens for, who spotted this, as I talked about on the podcast last week, about the fact that this was intended to ensure that opposition parties did get their division called when they propose an opposition day motion. What are your thoughts on the decision, the ruling that the Speaker made on in selecting that amendment? As the clerk acknowledged, he had the power to do it, but it did sort of fly in the face of that convention. Was that a very serious blunder?
It was in terms of precedent because it helps to obviously facilitates the smooth operation of the House if you proceed on the basis of knowing the procedure and what's going to happen, and it also protects the independence of the Speaker. It's rather like the monarch; you proceed by way of precedence, so your actions are predictable. So it puts you above the political fray. You're not actually taking an independent decision. Now, the moment you start to move away from that, you are taking a decision which, as you say, it was in the Speaker's gift to do, but it goes away from precedent and how you'd expect the Speaker to behave, and therefore brings him into the realm of controversies. So that was the at the heart of it, that departure and the advice given by the clerk that, in line with precedent, it is a significant departure, but recognizing it was in the Speaker's gift. But we know the last time this happened, which was under John Bercow, it proved equally controversial.
And you mentioned John Bercow there, which was the last time we saw this level of focus being sort of given to the intricacies of standing orders and the selection of amendments. Those, though, were on quite substantial, significant, efficacious motions that, you know, this was about whether we left the European Union without a deal or not. In that respect, do you think that on this one issue, which, you know, however important the issue under this discussion was an SNP opposition day motion. Is it surprising to you, as it is to me, that the House seems to have reacted much more strongly and much more formally to this mistake, as the Speaker has himself acknowledged it to be, when we didn't quite see this level of concerted opposition to those very, as I say, I think much more efficacious departures from precedent by Speaker Bercow.
Yes, it was just a declaratory motion that effectively was being debated. It wasn't something within the government's gift in terms of policy to change what actually happened. So in that sense, you could say, well, it was remarkable given the nature of what was before the House. It was more to do, I think, with the strength of feeling than the actual consequences in terms of the substance. So that, yes, I mean, you're quite right in terms of what was before the House. But I think it was the impact of it in terms of just how strongly members felt, and that the Speaker was seen fairly otherwise as being unduly influenced by political forces.
And in terms of what he said about Standing Order 31, he said he's referring this now to the Procedure Committee to have a look at it. Beyond all of the sort of heat and light of last week's proceedings, is there an issue here about the fact that this is a procedure that recognises a very binary division between an opposition and government, which is the way the House works, to be fair. But it does mean that in circumstances like this, where you do have different views amongst more than two parties, if you want all of those motions to be tested, it's a problem. And we've seen this problem in other respects as well, whether it's in Commons votes on reforming the House of Lords, or even the election of the Speaker himself or themselves. In the past, when you have a multi-option decision to make. The House of Commons procedure is not very good at recognising more than sort of two possible outcomes, is it?
Depends on how it's depends on the procedure itself. Because when it was Lords reform, what to do about it? Where it's just seeking the opinion of the House, they actually had a range of options, and they just voted on each one. That was fairly straightforward. It's a bit like during Brexit when they had indicative votes, and pretty similar in the sense that you ended up knowing what the House was against, but not what it was for. This was different in terms of the procedures that applied to it. And part of it is to do with interpretation of the actual rules and the use of language, and in particular the use of the word forthwith, which is exists in standing orders quite frequently, but potentially is quite problematic in terms of its interpretation, which we discovered with John Bercow. So there is something for the Procedure Committee certainly to examine and potentially come up with recommendations as to how to address the particular problem.
And finally, this was, as we've said, on an opposition day motion from the SNP. A lot of people won't have sort of tuned into the significance of opposition day motions. We've seen quite a lot of issues in the past, whether it's the government sort of refusing to play ball and not voting on them, or considering them not to be binding or not to be in any way substantive, and that caused problems for a while, and they stopped doing that. When we got to last week's vote, effectively the government sort of went back to that approach and said we're going to take the ball and walk off the pitch. And it's interesting to hear the Leader of the House, I think the following day, say that she stands there as a servant of the House and to be the defender of the rights of all members, as the Speaker does. But when it comes to the opposition parties, particularly the small opposition parties, as we found, there's something to be said here, isn't there, for the fact that the sort of majoritarian rule in the Commons, which is the way it works, if you have a majority, you can change standing orders to whatever you want. It does underline rather significantly that the opposition parties are really dependent on the goodwill of the government and the majority in order to have their say.
Well, that's true. And the rules largely derive from the existence of a government and an opposition. So government versus opposition proved quite problematic trying to incorporate third parties into that process. I mean, it's done as with opposition days, where 17 of the 20 are selected, or the topics on 17 of 20 are selected by the opposition, but three selected by the third largest party. So some recognition of that. But you're quite right in the sense of relying on a majority, because that can change standing orders, and government's not normally got a majority. But that has to be offset by the recognition that the House proceeds by way of all parties playing by the rules of the game. So if the opposition decided it wasn't going to play by the rules of the game, it could cause enormous trouble by refusing to engage in certain activities. And that can clog up the way that the House operates. So effectively in the House, you've got what I previously termed an equilibrium of legitimacy. Each recognises the role of the other. So the opposition is often referred to as the alternative government, but the government is in effect the alternative opposition and recognises that. So it doesn't want to limit the opposition too much, because in future it may be in opposition. So I do remember, it's quite some years ago now, there was a discussing procedure. The government opposed it in its role effectively as the alternative opposition. It didn't want to restrict the opposition too much. So yes, it's in the government's gift if it's got a majority, but at the same time, there are certain dangers if you just try and use those, manipulate the rules for your own benefit, because in the long run, it may come back and bite you.
That's a really interesting point, and one which we'll probably come back to within the next year, I imagine. But it is quite telling, just on that, that a lot of the reforms we've seen that have enhanced the facilities or opportunities the opposition have come from a government that has recently been in opposition. And so that, I think that point about it being the alternative opposition is a very important one for people to recognise. Having talked about that and a lot of the disquiet, not just on the SNP benches, there's been a lot of Conservative MPs joining in the criticism of the Speaker. And on many things we've seen over recent years, an increasing level of unrest in both parties and propensity to rebel on particular things. But the Parliamentary Conservative Party, if we use that without capital letters, as the backbench Conservative MPs, do have a very important role in providing pressure, not just on the Speaker, but usually more often on their own side, on the government. And so I thought it was, given that you have last year published, or towards the end of last year, your book on the 1922 Committee, to just take an opportunity to talk to you about that and also the role of backbench conservatives. But let's go back to the beginning on all of that and clear up the most common misconceptions about it. You say at the beginning of the book that it should never be a pub quiz question as to what is the 1922 committee, but what is the answer and what is it not?
Well, it is formally the body of private members in the House of Commons who are in receipt of the Conservative Whip. So those comprise the 1922 committee. Now, there are others who may attend, they're invited to attend, so that now includes ministers, that's since 2010. It also includes members of the Conservative members of the House of Lords or members of the House of Lords in receipt of the Conservative Whip. And that goes back to the late 60s since they started inviting peers to attend. So there are various people who may attend the meetings, but the actual membership of the 1922 committee comprises private members in receipt of the Conservative Whip. So that means when in opposition, the leader is excluded. And when in government, it's the leader and who's the prime minister and ministers who are excluded.
And the other misconception that you highlight at the beginning of the book is about its foundation. What is that misconception that needs clearing up?
Well, the name misleads people because they think 1922 committee, that 1922 is the year it was founded, and it isn't. The name derives from it being formed by the class of 1922. So members who were first elected in that year, the November 1922 election, they actually got together at the start of 1923. So it was actually founded on the 18th of April 1923. So that's why the book was published in 2023 to mark the centenary of the committee. But over the years, it's a you'll find it in textbooks, you'll find commentators saying, oh, it's founded in 1922. Even at times, the 1922 committee itself, certainly its executive, believed it was founded in 1922. There hasn't been a great institutional memory. So in 1972, they were thinking of organising an event to commemorate its 50th anniversary, and until a historian had to point out, well, you weren't actually formed 50 years ago. It's 1973 that's your 50th anniversary. That's when Philip Goodhart's book was published to mark its 50th anniversary. But even that didn't impact the executive later because 1992 they were doing it again, thinking that 1992 was the anniversary year, and it was 1993. So again, they had to be reminded of when it actually came into existence.
Yes, and that is an important distinction, isn't it? Because there is a sort of a view that it was created as a kind of a lobby group or a sort of very strong sort of group of sort of discontented backbenchers linked to the famous Carlton Club meeting that had ousted Austen Chamberlain. So you have that sort of connection in people's minds to 1922. It was a very significant year in the Conservative Party's history. And this idea of kind of the uprising of the backbenchers at the Carlton Club, that's kind of when we see the role of the 1922 committee now, you can see why people sort of think that that's what it is. But the distinction that you make, that it was actually effectively a new members club, meant that it was a very different beast in its early years, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. The people who think, oh, it's formed as a ginger group or to keep the leadership in check, that's what it's become. So today it's sort of the equivalent of that gathering in the Carlton Club. But when it was formed, it got nothing to do with that. It wasn't a result of it. And it wasn't in a position to keep the leader in check. It was just a number of newly elected MPs who had no great political clout. And of course, they themselves weren't party to the meeting in October 1922, because that comprised Conservative MPs. And 1922 committee was formed by those newly elected in the election that was triggered by that Carlton Club meeting. So when it came into being, it was effectively a self-help group. And in terms of its capacity to affect outcomes, it had a persuasive capacity only. It had no coercive capacity, had no sanctions. So it's just a discussion group, a means of exchanging information so that newly elected MPs could play a more active part in parliamentary life through knowing more about it. So it's essentially for information exchange and a forum in which they could hear from speakers. And that was largely the extent of it when it first came into being.
And why did it take on more significance than that? I think it was, Baldwin that you quote, sort of saying that, you know, ginger groups and other sort of backbench groups had sort of come and gone. He didn't seem to take it particularly seriously. But others did. I think notably the Chief Whip took it seriously and sort of helped to establish his position as a more sort of effective organisation.
Yes, because he recognised it wasn't a ginger group primarily. He recognised it was a forum that could be helpful to the party, could liaise with it and just help members to be more effective in the House as members. So they're quite fortunate in the initial Chief Whip, and then the next one, Boltnes Munsell, who was very sympathetic to it. So they liaised with it, kept it informed. They agreed that a whip should go along. In fact, first Chief Whip Leslie Wilson agreed a whip should go along to inform them of what business was coming up. So it's seen, I think, as some degree of mutual benefit. It certainly wasn't seen as a threat, and it wasn't a threat because it had no great leverage. So it only acquired a new role after 1940, because up until then, it wasn't a major force. It was overshadowed by, well, backbench party committees, which were formed by the leadership, not by the members, overshadowed by the big events of the day, which weren't really the subject of great debate within the 22. So the fights over the big issues, rearmament, India and so on, were taking place in the backbench subject committees and on the public platform. And it also shot itself in the foot in 1932, because after the economic crisis in 1931, it set up an economy committee to come up with recommendations for savings, operated through subcommittees, which operate in fairly watertight compartments. The eventual report was rushed out, published without being discussed in the full 1922 committee. It was quite controversial. Quite a number of members of the 22 were not happy with it being published without them agreeing to it. And that largely triggered them voting out the chairman, the founder chairman, Gervase Rentoul. And they were succeeded by chairman who sort of presided rather than led. They weren't particularly active necessarily in pushing the 22 committee forward. So it wasn't a significant force, particularly in the 30s, and might have died a death had it not been for the transformation facilitated by the formation of a national government in 1940. So in terms of development from what it was to where it is today, You could say there are three critical junctures, the first of which is its very formation. But the other two critical junctions were the formation of a national government in 1940, and then the introduction in 1965 of the election of the party leader by Conservative MPs, which gave a completely new role to the 22 committee.
And has its role historically been more significant in government or in opposition, would you say? Or certainly has its role differed between being in government and being in opposition?
Not necessarily. If you look at it, it's more over time, its relationship to the leadership has changed. That's the key thing, that since 1940, the leadership's had to take it seriously. It's really relied on it. So it acquired that significance because of the formation of a national government in 1940, because one had the formation of a all-party government. So adversarial politics on the public platform disappeared. Party organisation was actually wound down or went into hibernation. So the 22 committee remained as a distinctive Conservative voice. So they could put pressure on government. But behind closed doors, that was the key thing. And that related to the other reason it had leverage, because all parties were united in the prosecution of the war, and it meant that all parties had to be publicly united on the floor of the House, primarily as the government wanted that. So any disquiet had to be nipped in the bud earlier before it reached the public stage, before it reached the floor of the House. And so the 22 committee, for that matter, along with the Parliamentary Labour Party, provided a structured means of hearing any disquiet, addressing it. And so that gave the 22 significant leverage in relation to government. So Churchill, as Prime Minister, took it seriously. And towards the end of the war, it also provided a useful forum for members to discuss post-war Britain, which Churchill wasn't interested in. He was focusing on the war. So actually thinking ahead, the 22 committee provided a forum in which that could take place. So it acquired a new significance, and then that carried on into opposition. Churchill, largely an absentee leader. So 22 committee having quite some impact, putting pressure on party leaders. And then when it returned to government in 51, that carried on. And of course, with Churchill still being something of an absentee leader, no great interest in domestic policy, sort of created a vacuum that members of the 22 could fill and push for particular policies, which they did. So a notable success, for example, in relation to getting rid of the BBC's broadcast monopoly. Government were quite keen to retain it, couldn't see any need for change, couldn't see any demand for change. 22 was strongly in support of getting rid of that broadcast monopoly, and so the government conceded. So it really sort of, it was a developmental point, the way it's developed, whether in government or opposition. Its relationship to the leadership has sort of developed over time and now become very significant. Mm. And as I say, since 65, with the power of being able to elect, and then since 1975 to get rid of a leader if necessary, has really given it tremendous clout. Now, it matters, of course, especially when it's in government, because it may be putting a block on government policy. It may, of course, be removing a leader who happens to be prime minister. But that's the significance from a government point of view. But in opposition, it can be removing a leader. But of course, they're then leader of the opposition. But the relationship to the leadership has evolved over time.
Mm. And I mean, there is a slight difference, as you mentioned earlier, that in government, it's the whole government that is excluded from formal membership, and, yes, and in opposition it's just the leader, but as you say there, it maintains now, since it's had that formal role in determining the leadership, it has that role in government and opposition.
I was going to say, even in opposition, then front benchers are members, they can vote, but of course in leadership elections, but of course you don't know how they vote.
Yes, indeed. Rule number one of Conservative leadership elections is that MPs lie. The point, as you mentioned there, about the two key points, 65 and 75, about first of all having a role in the election of the leader, and then in 75 the removal of a leader. Those are the ones which I think the general public are now heartily, well, very familiar or heartily sick. I'm not sure which of those two.
Well, there's a third development which came in 1998, which is leaving it to the party membership to choose the leader from two candidates put forward by the Conservative MPs. Mm. And that's created an invitation to struggle between the 1922 committee and the party membership, and that's what we've seen in recent years.
Yes, and I was going to say on those early sort of introductions of their role in the process were initially amongst MPs themselves, so it kind of makes sense therefore that you have the 1922 doing that, but it's not a formal party organisation. It's never been a sort of creation of the party. So how sort of surprising was it that effectively it was canonized into sort of being a formal mechanism from 65 for the election of the leader, and as you say that's then evolved and until we get to now the mass membership party vote as well, still retaining that sort of gatekeeper role as well within the rules of what became the party constitution in 98. But for what was effectively an informal body of Conservative MPs and a self-regulated sort of body, that's quite a significant step up in formality, isn't it?
It is, but the big step was the 1998 one, because the power was given to the parliamentary party, or the 22, in 65. So they were left to elect the leader, decide the rules. The chairman of the 1922 committee, and it's always been a man, was the returning officer. But the real formalisation came in 1998, got a party constitution and a recognition of the role of the 22 in putting it before the party, two candidates before the party membership. 22 is still quite important, the executive deciding, you know, how many nominations you need to be a candidate and so on. So that can matter significantly, but it's been highly formalised since 98. And that's what's created the problems, not just the formality as such, but the fact that you're handing over to a party membership rather than MPs, and constitution, of course, prime minister and government rest on the confidence of the House of Commons, which in government means practice your own supporters. And here, the decision as to who should become leader and if you're in government, therefore become prime minister, was given to people outside the House of Commons. And of course, there's then a problem if that person doesn't command a majority in the House.
Mm. And this is an institutional problem that I think has not received enough attention. I know you have spoken about it at length, but I think it's one which it's not as though we haven't seen this happen. it happened to Ian Duncan Smith.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's
happened clearly to Liz Truss. It happened to an extent to Theresa May as well, that when you go to a party membership vote, you do so on the basis that you have two candidates, but the last vote is of three candidates, and so the last is eliminated. So it's almost baked into the process that you can't demonstrate in normal circumstances that the leader has the confidence of their party, which is a huge change. But that does make this this sort of mechanism that we have all become so familiar with now all the more important, which is that you now have a mechanism by which there's a quota of letters that have to go in expressing no confidence, calling for a vote of no confidence in the leader. That mechanism is obviously in the hands of the 22 and the chairman of the 22. So Graham Brady, who worth saying a bit about him as well, perhaps in your answer, being the longest serving chair of the 22, has become a very, very familiar figure as almost the kind of the kind of harbinger of doom for several Conservative prime ministers. But the fact that that's happened so regularly, do you think that is a reflection of the fact that we've had this this separation now between the feelings of Conservative MPs, which is kind of what the 22 is effectively there to represent, and the person who is effectively sort of potentially foisted on them as their leader.
Oh yes, because that's the way the rules operate. Because as you say, the two who are going to put before the party membership are chosen by eliminating ballots. If there are more than three candidates, so in that final ballot, there are three candidates. The top two go through to be placed before the party membership. But you've got three candidates in that last ballot. So you might come second with a very small minority of the votes of Conservative MPs and yet go on to be elected by the party membership, which is exactly what happened the first time it was used. So the final ballot of Conservative MPs, 2001, Ken Clark came top, only just, I think he got, 54 votes. Ian Duncan Smith came second with, I think, 51, one ahead of Michael Portillo. So basically, Ian Duncan Smith only had the support of about a third of the parliamentary party, but was elected, and he was also the first to be removed. Once the letters, so 2 years later, letters went in, vote of confidence held, he lost it. The MPs voted to remove him from the leadership. I mean, Liz Truss in the final ballot got 31% of the votes of Conservative MPs, went through and was elected as leader. So you can see sort of that problem, that invitation to struggle and the potential instability that derives from it. I mean, having said that, even if you get an absolute majority of the votes of Conservative MPs in the final ballot, that's no guarantee that you will necessarily be in office for a long time, because both Boris Johnson and Theresa May achieved an absolute majority in the final ballot. But you could argue the instability is most obvious if you don't get an absolute majority. And that in itself can have an impact on other candidates, because you may remember when Theresa May was a candidate, her opponent was Andrea Leadsom. Now, she withdrew ostensibly because of an interview she'd given to the Times, but she was already contemplating withdrawing before then, because she realised she didn't have majority support in the parliamentary party, and she could envisage being elected leader and then not that long afterwards, you know, being removed by the parliamentary party.
Mm. And this does focus attention on the sort of the power of Conservative MPs to remove their leaders. But it also highlights the fact that that's the ultimate sanction. But the fact that that ultimate sanction is there gives teeth to their scrutiny role. If we're going to talk about it in sort of internal party oppositional terms, the role of backbench MPs in holding to account, scrutinising and criticising their leadership is really given quite a lot of weight by leaders. From the history over the 100 years, what have been the most or some examples of the most effective examples of the 22, or rather the members of the 22, but the Conservative backbenchers having a material impact on the leadership through their opposition or criticism to party policy?
Well, they've had quite a number of impact over time. Some of the impact we may not know about, because of course it's not just decision making, it's non-decision making. So policy may come forward and then it runs into trouble, but you may get some ministers contemplating a policy and deciding, don't think this will wash with the 22, I shan't even bother bringing it forward, because of course then you don't know that that has happened, so you can't measure it. So you've got the problem of some policies proving unpopular, leadership having to fight to get them through, sometimes only just succeeding. So you've had various examples over time. Edward Heath, when president of the Board of Trade in 1964, getting rid of resale price maintenance, had a really difficult meeting with the 22, and about 200 members present at the meeting. And as one said, his arguments went down like a lead balloon. he didn't withdraw it, he pursued it. So the bill was brought forward. At one stage, the government, with a nominal majority of 100, got an amendment through with a majority of one. So it's a real struggle, but he succeeded. Others have not gone through or seen the light of day. And don't forget, it's not just policies, it's ministers themselves. So since 1954, that was the first occasion we saw a minister resign because he'd lost the confidence of the 1922 committee. So that was Sir Thomas Dugdale, the agriculture minister over Critchell Dam. And you saw it later. And of course, you saw it especially during the premierships of Margaret Thatcher and John Major. You had several cabinet ministers resign because they'd lost the confidence of the 1922 committee. I mean, there's Lord Carrington over the Falklands, had a very bruising meeting and realised, told John Notter he's leaving, I don't think I can go on, and resigned. Leon Britton, as Trade and Industry Secretary over the Westland crisis, went before the 22, that was a really bruising meeting, very difficult, and resigned the next day. David Mellor went, he made the headlines because of a kiss and tell story by a lover, but went because he'd accepted a holiday from someone whose father was finance director of the PLO. So, you know, Mellor got a call from the chairman of the 1922, Sir Marcus Fox, basically telling him his time was up.
Mm.
Nicholas Ridley went as well from trade and industry because he'd met a interview he'd given about Germany and disobliging comments he'd made, and basically the 22 made clear couldn't really continue. And then you had junior ministers, Edwina Curry over Salmonella and people like that, went as well. So during that sort of Thatcher Major period, quite a number of ministers went. I suppose more recently, relatively recently, a decade ago, about Andrew Mitchell, Chief Whip, you may remember the altercation with police at the gates of 10 Downing Street, became very controversial. Discussed at the 22 committee. The committee was clearly quite divided over it. And Andrew Mitchell saw the 22 executive after the meeting, asked them to give their support, public support to him, which they said, well, while personally sympathetic, they didn't feel they could do. He realised, right, and basically he resigned. So it's got quite a lot of clout, obviously, in terms of the determining the fate of ministers and indeed their policies, and really getting them to take action or ceasing to take action on particular policies, including prime ministers. Good example, David Cameron during the period of coalition, where the 22 played an important role in making sure there was a bit like in the national government of 1940 to 45, making sure there was a conservative voice when the Conservative Party was in government, but was not alone in government. So on the referendum on the alternative vote, I mean, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, wanted to take something of a back seat because he didn't want to upset the his Liberal Democrat coalition partners. The 1922 was took a somewhat different view, that it was important the Prime Minister was to the fore in leading the campaign, drumming up support, getting donors to support the no side. And so the Prime Minister decided better follow what the 22 committee said rather than the pressure from his Liberal Democrat Deputy Prime Minister. So because Baroness Farsi was the party chairman at the time, she had a very difficult meeting with the 22 initially. The executive saw the Prime Minister and said, do you really want to be the last Conservative Prime Minister? So really put the pressure on him to pull his finger out and take a lead in the campaign, which he did, which obviously didn't help relations with the Liberal Democrats in government.
And you say at the start of the book that in terms of the anthropological study that you've done of the 22, that you've called yourself a participant observer. You've been engaging in participant observation as a tactic. Because since you joined the Lords in 98, as a Conservative peer, you're entitled to attend it, and I gather have diligently done so week in, week out. So you've mentioned a few of the sort of ones since your time as an attendee. Give us a bit of a flavour of sort of, you know, how those kind of make or break meetings take place, because, you know, they are literally behind closed doors. And I've wandered along on some occasions when I worked in the House to sort of, you know, it becomes quite a scene in the corridor outside Committee Room 14 of journalists and other sort of rubberneckers, really, of sort of, you know, from the Labour Party or others, crowding into the corridor, not quite putting a glass against the door, but, you know, listening out for the famous sound of the banging of the desks, and then trying to catch people going in and trying to get comments from people as they come out and trying to get, you know, and back in the day, that was the only way they could get the information. Now I suspect they're getting it all WhatsApp to them in real time, but that's probably another matter. But, you know, within that closed door meeting, within the sort of the Committee Room 14, in those make or break meetings, it is a sort of an example, not to get sort of too highly fleeting about this, but it is a bit of a sort of, you know, it's raw opposition, isn't it? It's kind of, you know, when you've got a sizable proportion of MPs who are opposed to a particular person or very critical, or when, you know, a leader is under attack and they appear at this make or break meeting of the 22, you really are facing down your internal dissent in a very physical way. Give us an impression of sort of, you know, how you can tell, you know, the mood of the room and things. Give us a bit of flavour of that.
Well, there's one obvious indication, which is who's turned up. Because most weeks there isn't any great controversy. There might be a handful of members. It's not necessarily well attended, even if you've got a cabinet minister talking about the departmental brief. There's no great, great issue. You might have 20 or 30 MPs present, sometimes less. I do recount the meeting when the attendance was so low, I got a cheer when I entered the room. And
it surely happens there all the time, Philip.
Well, yes, but silently. And that's more the norm than the exception. There's not necessarily a great turnout, which I suppose makes it even more significant when there is a big event and, you know, there's a very large turnout. It's a make or break meeting, and then it becomes significant. And as you say, the committee corridor then becomes crowded, because most weeks you might have there's just one lone journalist outside looking pretty lonely, and that's it. But when it's a really critical event, you know, as you say, you've actually got to almost force your way through to get into the room because there are so many people crowding outside. And you've had some real make or break events. Now, one obvious case, of course, would be after the 2017 general election, when the party had gone into the election campaign, massive lead, expected to come out with a very large majority, ended up still the largest party, but without a majority. So Theresa May had to go and address the 22 at the beginning of the new parliament. And that was basically to save her premiership. So to appear before the 22 and made it was a very good speech, one of contrition. And it worked, but it was really, you know, intense, absolutely packed, as you might expect. It's a standing room only. So you always know this is really serious. When you've got to, you know, difficult getting into the room, not just getting through people to get into the room, but going into the room and finding grief, it's the space for me. So you get these, when you have packed meetings like that, you know it's serious. And obviously an event like that, basically fighting for her political life, which she did very successfully. And got a very good reception, and hence all the banging of the desks and things like that. But yeah, you do get those make or break meetings. They're the exception, though, but not the rule. The sort of not brilliantly attended meetings are more the rule. And you get the odd meeting where there's no speaker, and therefore you just transact a bit of business and it's over within a few minutes.
Mm. And finally, you sort of draw towards the end of the book, the conclusion that Well, no spoilers for those, close your ears. But the fact that the story is that it basically becomes what it was assumed to be at the beginning, that some
Right.
people, that Baldwin thought it was another sort of ginger group
Yes.
that was going to be trouble, and it wasn't. It was a sort of self-help group, and your broad conclusion is that it has actually become that now, that it has become that sort of means of exerting accountability of the leadership to the conservative backbench MPs.
Yeah.
How significant, is the 22 to the study of politics and to this sort of, as I say, this what we're interested in, this sort of idea of kind of internal dissent, internal opposition
Yes.
within a party?
Well, to use a phrase that my students seem to associate with me, it's necessary but not sufficient. So you've got to be aware of it because of the consequences it may have, because things happen in terms of government, what they come forward with. And if you don't know what's happening in the 22, you may not know what, where on earth has that come from. So it may be a change in policy. It may be a policy that derived from the 22. So you've really got to delve into what's going on in order to know what the consequences are of the 1922 committee. So it's necessary because it have an impact, can have a massive impact, but most of the time it's fulfilling functions which don't relate to public policy or the leadership. They're discussing issues, they're acting as a forum for the exchange of information, for hearing speakers to inform themselves, and just mixing with one another. That sort of importance that there always is for members to belong. So just to reinforce the tribal element, so just meeting is has certain value, and it's the sort of the exchange of information acting as a platform for raising issues. That's the ongoing relevance of it, whereas the sort of the big event, the leadership's under crisis, under pressure, there's a policy proving controversial, that those are the exceptions and not the rule. And of course, largely it's a reactive body. So in terms of public policy, it's the government that's generating that is the driving force. And most of the time, the 22 isn't going to impinge on, ministers' consciousness of their policies. They'll go along, they'll explain what they're doing, and that's fine. But it's the occasion when they trip, they say something that's controversial, or bring forward a policy that's controversial, then it becomes significant. But that is the exception, it's not the rule. So yes, it matters, but it's not a body on a continuing basis that's really impacting necessarily public policy. So it's really the government in the driving seat in the promulgation and getting public policy through. But the 1922 committee is there. It can have a major impact, and on occasion it does. So it matters, and ministers know that. And of course, the party leader knows that, particularly in the light of the rules that we've discussed about the leadership.
And if they didn't know that it matters after the last few years, they really haven't been paying attention, I think we can conclude. Philip, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Philip's book, The 1922 Committee, Power Behind the Scenes, is published by Manchester University Press at the very reasonable price of £20, which is highly unusual for academic publishing and a trend to be welcomed, I think, just as your last book was as well. But I'm sure we'll speak again. Thanks also for giving us your thoughts on the row over the speaker's ruling last week. But for the moment, Philip Norton, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And I'm sure we will have lots to discuss during the course of this year. I'm sure there'll be plenty more parliamentary shenanigans that it'll be useful to get Philip's views on. But my thanks to him for discussing the 1922 committee with me, and apologies for the slightly dodgy sound quality at times. I was recording that on a laptop on Zoom on Wi-Fi with a microphone that wasn't as great as I thought it was. So not my usual setup, and apologies for that, but I'm a bit of an audio snob anyway, so I find it slightly annoying when it's not top notch. But great to hear from Philip Norton on both those issues. And particularly on the issue of the speaker that we discussed at the beginning, because it is one that does seem to be rumbling on. It was notable during Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday that he wasn't intervening to call for order, and he did seem rather chastened by what has happened to him, and that does call into question his ability to effectively do the job. Had some interesting conversations this week as well with some people in and around Parliament that suggest that there is quite a lot of criticism of him behind the scenes as well for the decision that he took, and so this is certainly not over. I don't think it's an open question as to whether that pressure will continue to build, and whether that will have an effect this side of the election. So that's one to certainly keep an eye on, along with the many other issues in politics. And who knows? I may be back with more bonus episodes as developments start to build during this extraordinary election year that we're going to be seeing. So my thanks to you for listening, and do make sure you're subscribed to the podcast. Give us a good review, spread the word, and help people to find it. That will be very helpful. My thanks to Philip Norton for joining me on this episode, and I'll be back again very soon. But for the moment, thanks very much for listening. Look after yourselves, and I'll see you again soon. You've been listening to Opposition Cast from the Centre for Opposition Studies, presented by me, Nigel Fletcher. Our theme music is by Tom Hector, and you can find us on Twitter @OppositionUK and online at oppositionstudies.net.